the fact that maybe I have a little bit of burning concern to you know, see how we can push gender for greater relevance. I mean, yeah, poverty, food security, you know, we've done that over the years. I'm personally eager to see gender, you know, being discussed at a different level for a change, to bring it to the here and now, as it were. Because when it comes to gender and agriculture, the issues have remained, you know, almost falsified over the years. You know, the issues of feminized poverty, poverty of women, the constraints against women, which are really, really challenging. And in spite of, you know, years and years of activism, yes, there changes are being made, more from social mobilization than from real positive policy changes. So I decided that this year, well, because the theme is on the financial crisis, that let's see how we can bring gender into the issue of the food crisis. And, you know, perhaps, you know, see how relevant it will also be to the financial crisis. Because, yes, by that we are bringing it to a broader level, aren't we? And I know that there have been concerns about relevance since, I mean, yesterday there was a heated argument about the relevance of gender at the macro level. Well, I would hope that by just this simple, it's more like a conceptual paper, that we'll be able to, you know, come to some conclusion, a happier conclusion, that gender can actually fit into the here and now, into what is happening in the broad global economy. Yeah, and so the topic is gender, food crisis, and food security in developed and developing countries. I have not focused specifically on sub-Saharan Africa on the issue of food crisis, because, like I said, the issues have not even entered the discourse, you know, as far as sub-Saharan Africa is concerned. And then where there have been suggestion of, you know, how gender could interface with this problem, there is actually lack of data, because when we're talking about the food crisis, we're talking about a period from, say, 2006 up till now. And, you know, go out looking for data, maybe the best you get is 2005. So it's not really possible to empirically show, you know, whether there's relevance or not. So what I've done is to look at developed countries as a whole and developing countries as a whole, and try to situate, you know, their comparative position in this phenomenon called the food crisis, and how that links, of course, with their food security. So this is the outline of the presentation. I'll skip, you know, some aspects that have been touched on by earlier speakers. Want to distinguish, as it were, between food crisis and food security, and then briefly discuss the dimensions and indicators of the global food crisis. I'll also go through the structural and immediate causes of the food crisis and consequences of the food crisis, that is at the level of developed nations and then at the level of developing countries. I bring in the issue of climate change as a major intervening factor in this phenomenon of food crisis and actually food security. It's not an immediate cause, but it's having immediate consequences in the efforts to mitigate the food crisis. And in trying to bring gender into this interface, we look at the gender dimensions of the causes and the effects. And of course, I now see whether in the search for solution, there have been solutions, in the search for solutions, is it possible, you know, to consider the gender dimensions of the envisaged changes. Now, I start by looking at a working definition of food crisis. And I say that it's a situation in which masses of the people are faced with a disequilibrium in the food market occurring over a relatively short period of time, due to a policy shock or natural and man-made disaster. And on the other hand, it's like food security compromised. Food crisis, you know, could compromise the food security of an already food secure population, as it were. And at the same time, it could worsen the food insecurity of an already food insecure population. And food security in its three dimensions, as I think Indira went over that, it involves the use of supply, location, and price, that is availability, accessibility, and affordability. And I say that a deterioration in food consumption, both in quantity and quality, is also, you know, a definition, it's a relevant definition of this food crisis, whereby the response or coping mechanisms lead to a lowered quality of life of a large segment of the population. In distinguishing between the two, we note that food crisis is an acute situation, whereas food security is usually a chronic situation that might have been manifesting over a long period of time in a systemic manner in a particular population. Of course, acute food crisis is, say, an acute acute condition of food insecurity. Food crisis is therefore not synonymous with food insecurity, although food security is a necessary but insufficient condition for managing food crisis. So in trying to mitigate a food crisis, we look beyond the causes and look at the effects, because the effects would manifest as food insecurity and also. And so food security must be addressed in trying to address a food crisis. Now, the current food crisis, although we'll talk about the real causes later, note that this has been triggered at a higher level of technological production, that is at the aggregate production level. The indicators are aggregate, you know, price, supply at the global level, at a regional and country level. And it's been triggered from the end of the developed countries or the net food exporters, where agriculture contributes less than 10% of GDP. But food insecurity, you know, which is a phenomenon we have been coping with, especially in Africa and much of the developing country, has, you know, occurred at a different level, systemically, I say, because it runs through the whole structure of livelihood and especially agricultural production systems among net food importers, whose economies depend on agriculture. But they contribute, I mean, in terms of employment, but agriculture contributes less than 60% of GDP. That's less than, not greater than. So food crisis, from the perspective of less developed countries, is reinforcing already, you know, structural problem of food insecurity. I think my point is clear that for developing countries, it's like hunger just gotten worse, right, as it were. The food insecurity has been there for most of them, and then this food crisis is triggered to worsen the level of food insecurity. Whereas from the perspective of developed countries, the food crisis is creating new populations of food insecure. Well, in a theoretical sense, I'm also identifying how food insecurity itself can lead to food crisis. That is, for the food insecure population, they could also go into food crisis if there is an acute crisis such as famine or, you know, some unmitigated demand-supply gap. And but this particular food crisis, like I said, is felt at the level of supply, at the macro level. Food security is felt at the level of consumption. And yes, I've mentioned that acute food insecurity, which comes from food crisis, can be worsened by poverty in low-income countries. I will go to the next slide. These are conceptual issues, actually. And of course, other characteristics of a food crisis, the occurrences that will occur in a situation of food crisis would include like social and political conflicts, for instance, you know, such as have been experienced in, you know, in some countries lately in the wake of this food crisis. And then we have a situation where the poor are more vulnerable due to limited safety nets, because they have limited assets, they have limited skills to change their livelihood over a short period of time to smoothen their consumption in the immediate. For the poor, labor is their greatest asset, usually their only asset. And when agricultural systems are dysfunctional in a situation of food crisis, they are trapped in a high labor, low return activity. And women, this is where women really come in. In a situation of food, acute food insecurity, the poorest, and especially women, are hardest hit because they have limited assets, you know, to smoothen consumption. Now, among these poor are the large population of farmers. And of course, women are the bottom of the rung of the ladder among poor farmers. Therefore, the low capacity to respond appropriately on the supply side would cyclically reinforce their food crisis. These are all concepts, you know, that work into each other to present what we have today, where some parts of the world are really suffering, you know, going to a level of deprivation as a result of the food crisis. While in other parts of the world, yeah, food crisis is there, it's just manifesting, not necessarily in terms of acute poverty, but changing lifestyles or purchasing power in different ways. Now, the key indicators of the food crisis that I want to briefly look at, as far as data is concerned, the area of supply shortfalls, that's a major indicator. When there's supply shortfall, then there is and demand is not slowing down, we're likely to have a food crisis. The you see the graphs later, but let me go over this. Then we have sharp and rapid food price inflation. I'm sure all the symptoms are familiar with those of us that are that have been, yes, you've been following the food crisis. Variability in price and supply of food and related food drivers. The price variability may not only be in terms of the food itself, but other substitutes of food or other commodities that are relevant to the production and marketing of food, such as oil. Oil for transportation of food is a relevant driver of a food price. And when there's variability in the price of such food drivers, you have a price variability, or I mean price hike. And of course, widening demand-supply gap. I said when supply is falling and demand is not falling appropriately, I mean in the same at the same rate. When supply is falling at a higher rate than demand, is also slowing down. Or on the other hand, when demand is rising at a higher rate than, you know, supply is changing. Now, I refer to the cobweb theorem here because normally in literature, the cobweb theorem is a popular one whereby you situate the rational farmer. Normally what happens is that when price of a commodity, say cassava, rises in a given year, what happens? Prices crash because there's oversupply. When prices crash, the following season, many farmers will go out of cassava production, or they will reduce the land they devote to cassava, and then there will be shortage of cassava, and then the price will go up. When the price goes up, other farmers are drawn back into the system. You know, this is what you call supply response to price. So you end up having like a cobweb. This year, it's the price goes up, and the next it comes down, and so on and so forth. Now, you expect that in this situation, if there is an acute price rise, the natural response of farmers is to, you know, respond appropriately and, you know, produce more. And in that case, there should not be the recurrent supply shortage. But for some reason, farmers are not responding to the price signal. So we're going to ask ourselves why that would not be happening. Of course, the trade dimension of the food crisis is that you expect, as we have, huge trade deficits in net importing countries who now have to pay higher prices for, you know, each unit of food, and reduce export revenue in net food exporting countries, most of which are the developed countries. And the net result is that there's a decline in the flow of capital between trading partners, between developed and developing countries, as it were, between the net food exporters and the net food importers. Now, another question which needs to be substantiated when talking about food crisis. Everybody's talking about food crisis. Every nation is talking about food crisis, the small nations, the big nations. You know, nations that have had their problems of structural agricultural dysfunction are also talking about food crisis. Now, maybe it's not food crisis. Maybe the food crisis is not as pervasive. Maybe it is happening in some countries. It's not happening in some others. So, of course, an indicator of this is to see to what extent the price movement locally, the domestic price movement, correlates with the global price movement. We know that the price hike is at the global level. But is it every country that is experiencing the same degree of price hike closely correlated? You may find that, you know, if you have data for individual countries and you assess this, some countries may be experiencing price hike but may not be related to food crisis, because their price hike would have been occurring at a given level over a longer period of time. So the causes of their price hike may be unrelated to the immediate causes of the food crisis. That's the purpose of that indicator. We just try to pick some of these indicators as we find data. That's the trend in global food prices between 2007 and 2008. And you can see the sharp rise. That's a quarterly price data at the world level. You can see the sharp rise at some point. The food price index is the middle one, you know, that draws, yes, between. But then you have different commodities rising and falling. Variability is expressed. And then, of course, the positive and sharp rise is very visible there. On the other hand, you have the price of crude, which is a food price driver, as I explained. The price of crude has risen also very sharply, as we all know. And then this measures the variability, month-to-month variability of the crude oil prices over, you know, this is actually from July 2007 to June 2008, just over a one-year period. Now, we find that the world stock of major cereals, that's the supply side of the food crisis. This graph shows the ratio of, the ratio of total utilization to the world stock. You see, you have the world stock of major cereals and other commodities, and then you have utilization, withdrawal of stock for the purpose of utilization. Normally, stock is replenished maybe at a rate that is usually at least at the same rate as that of utilization, or at a higher rate. But over this period, utilization, you know, has been at a higher rate than the level than the rate of replenishment. So you have utilization over stock, you know, giving a declining trend. And of course, the stock itself, the total stock, is expressed here. You can see that, well, this is over a period of 2003 to 2008. We have, it doesn't have the sharp rise that you would expect for prices, but the key indicator is the ratio of utilization to the stock itself, the rate at which the stock is being depleted. It's apparently been much higher. Now, what are the major causes of this food crisis? Of course, there have been other food crises in the past, historically, caused by other kinds of shock, depression, war, and so on. And indeed, in developed countries in Africa, the structural adjustment of the early and mid-80s signifies one of the first food crisis of the is it the millennium, as it were. Now, the causes of this food crisis have actually been predicted. A document by a study by IFPRI in 1999 predicted all these changes, looking at the trend in the world economy, all the changes in the parameter changes that would eventually lead to this food crisis had been predicted. For instance, population growth, you know, has been predicted to rise by 70%, you know, by 2010, with global urban population doubling and urban population, urban population in developing countries rising by 52%. Growth in world income is also estimated to be at the rate of 4.3% annually, which is fairly high for this period, meaning that prosperity, you know, is expected to be on the increase. Growth in food demand, especially due to this rising prosperity in populous India and China, has also been predicted as a possible trigger. And per capita cereal demand in East Asia, for instance, was estimated, you know, to rise from 66 kilograms to 373 kilograms, to a lesser degree in sub-Saharan Africa from 143 to 156 over the same period. You have change in diets of the more prosperous. As people get more prosperous, they begin to demand different kinds of food. They begin to withdraw from cereals and demand more of livestock proteinous food. And of course, the demand, greater demand for livestock products puts a demand on cereals, not so, because there's now a competition between humans and animals for the same stock. And if efforts have not been made to drastically increase the supply of cereals, then we would end up having the kind of problem that we have now. Apart from this, there are the what I call the systemic, the immediate causes, which we are familiar with. Of course, the sharp rise in oil prices resulting from unstable production of major producers, the war in Iraq, and I'm sure many of us are familiar with the disruptions in the Niger Delta of Nigeria, which has led to a shortage in supply and contributing to the rise. When the price of oil and when the price of oil rises, price of products of oil or oil derivatives also rise. Fertilizer is one of them. That's an inorganic fertilizer. There's been high and concurrent rise in fertilizer price, and of course, acute rise in transportation costs for farm inputs and outputs. There has been erratic capital flow into commodity markets. Now, because of this is a link with the financial crisis. Because of the financial crisis and drop when the interest rate dropping out of its bottom, as it were, in other areas, speculators were believed to have moved massively into the commodity markets, into buying commodity futures and options, and this transmitted back into the price level. And then, of course, there is the issue of biofuel, which has been mentioned, I think, by Yassin, as a substitute for fossil fuel. That is in response, that the immediate aspect of that is that when oil price is on the sharp rise, people began to look more at biofuel, and this, you know, calls on the use of cereals, which would otherwise have been used for human consumption, to produce biofuel. Of course, there are, I said, beyond green policies, because the green policies are, you know, long-standing issues, not of an immediate cause. I've talked about increased competition. Now, climate change, which I will treat later in a bit more detail, has impacted on farmers' response capacity. Well, one would expect that under normal circumstances, with a food crisis of this dimension, farmers will still have the capacity to respond. I talked about the supply response, you know, intensify their production, maybe use more resources in order to have surplus to take advantage of the price rise. But because of the effect of climate change on soils, on water bodies, on, you know, the environment of farming, poorer yields, you know, have been recorded from fragile lands, and of course, livelihoods in general are being compromised by climate change, limiting the capacity of farmers to respond. We have conflicts and civil strikes in many parts of the developing world, and an increasing population of vulnerable, and thereby reducing the population of producers. The scourge of HIV is, we've talked about that, decimating the farming population. Yes, the other intervening problems are structural problems, like I mentioned later. These are the green policies have been in place, urging countries, you know, to reduce the use of fossil fuel in favor of biofuels, and actually subsidizing farmers to produce for biofuel production. Of course, decline in growth rate of supply has also been experienced due to excessive fertilizer use. This is in developed countries, right? In developed countries, fertilizer use has been a constant. And of course, with subsidies on fertilizer and other inputs, farmers in developed countries have been using fertilizer to the maximum application level compared to what is used in developing countries. So this fertilizer effect has also led to decline in yield of a lot of major crops, contributing to the supply shortage. This is a structural problem. It's not an immediate problem. It's been occurring over time. In developing countries, on the other hand, of course, we have population growth being one of the major structural problems. That is, rapid rate of population compared to the growth rate of supply of food. Low technological inputs, and of course, including fertilizer, which is about, currently in sub-Saharan Africa, is about 10% or less of quantities being used in developed countries. So while developed countries are using excessive fertilizer, as it were, degrading their soil and reducing productivity, developing countries have not been using enough to give optimum yield. Growing feminization of agriculture is a major structural cause in developing countries. We know all the mantra about feminization of agriculture. We've mentioned it on and off today, but the totality of that is that because of pauperization of the agricultural system, men have been migrating out of agriculture, or migrating from food crop agriculture to more remunerative types of agriculture, leaving women to manage small agricultural systems that feed the livelihoods of rural people and indeed generate surplus for urban population. Yeah. Of course, liberalization policies have contributed a lot in dampening the supply of developing countries. We know the story about withdrawal of subsidies in the input market, and then liberalization of the output market. All these ones, and with price variation, mitigating the ability of the farmers to actually go out and produce at higher level. Policy failures are very important. In developed countries, investment in agriculture has been consistently low. In the past, in the past three decades, changing positively at some point during the structural adjustment, the post-structural adjustment, but then declining again to a level that is yet unacceptable for a country that that wants to improve its agriculture. Now, you have poor link with commodity value chain, especially by women farmers. This is an important point. So income has not been remunerative. And I mentioned climate change. That comes up again. Now, I talked about this supply response, and I think I'll leave that as it is. Normally, the rational farmer, the farmer in anywhere, should be taking advantage of this price rise, but they are not, because input price index is higher than food price index. I have a chart here of the price of fertilizer between 2006 and 2008. Look at the sharp increase. And this is the price index of food. The main food price index is the lowest one. But the price index of the food drivers, which are fuel and fertilizer, are actually at a higher level, the indices are at a much higher level than the food itself. So no wonder the rational farmer would be at a loss if he were to respond to these signals of input price being perhaps higher than output price. Now, the consequences, we know the consequences all too well. For the net importers, trade deficits, we talked about this yesterday during, I think, Mariama's, we alluded to this. And then, of course, which has impacted on fiscal development, especially expenditure into human development programs, which includes gender empowerment programs. Hunger and food insecurity has aggravated, closely related to dimensions of the crisis. And therefore, net importers, loss of trade surpluses, further constraining capital flows. That is in addition to the financial crisis. Now, in developed countries, the consequences, high inflation rates, of course. I'm sure we are familiar with the way that the food crisis has been manifesting. High inflation rates, look at the rate of inflation that is reported in May 2008. For US, it has been the highest since 1996, mainly the major contributor being the food crisis. And then, of course, transport costs, which is coming from the price of oil. Now, as stocks of cereals deplete and future cereal production shared between food and industrial uses, there will not be enough food to meet some international obligations, especially in terms of food pledges to World Food Program. That means the commitment of developed countries to developing countries is compromised by the food crisis. And, of course, we know what this. I said, future depression in supply is envisaged unless fertilizer prices are further subsidized. Now, if fertilizer prices are further subsidized, it is further entrapping net food importers because we're going to come back to the same circuitous situation. Now, this I would leave to the end. What I did, I'm not good at making frameworks. I'm not good at, drawing frameworks, but I think that as we go through a lot of these factors, the occurrences from financial prosperity in the developed countries to poverty in the developing countries, we have transmission of the effects of the food crisis, from financial crisis to food crisis and backwards. I will not go through this, but if we were to have a quick exercise in what we think are the transmission mechanisms from food crisis, or from financial crisis to food crisis, and vice versa, and then from developed countries to developing countries, we're going to have a very interesting framework. And if we can, I don't want to use the word splice gender in. I mean, if we can engender that framework, we would come up with a strong, it will not be empirical evidence, but a conceptual evidence to show that this crisis, this global crisis, as it were, do not preclude gender, that gender relations are implicated in these occurrences and that the consequences are important for gender and the mitigation of them must also include gender. This would be a kind of, like I said, I don't know how to make frameworks. If anybody knows how to make frameworks, I think I would like to try, like us to try our hands on something that can link the financial crisis with the food crisis. Now, it's been general so far. Gul, I've spent a lot of my time. Well, I'll take a little because I'm just getting into the gender of it. Now, how is gender relevant to all this? I've been talking in the generic. How is gender relevant to it? Because that's why we're here. Well, women are both producers and consumers of food crops and livestock, and they have a larger stake both for themselves and for their family. We're getting to the level of food security. And usually that is where women's issues come on, at the level of food security, household food security. Now, women and children are more vulnerable to food, fuel, and fertilizer price increases and to rural poverty in general because of the gendered pattern of entitlement to land, capital, and other resources they need to respond to policy and climatic shock. I think that is clear to everybody. That is familiar literature and concept. Now, women are also relevant to the food crisis because in some countries we have seen that women have been at the forefront of protests you know, on the basis of this food crisis, they have, you know, led the protest to petition governments to do something about it, meaning that they feel it perhaps more than other members of the population. And the consequence also, you know, reflect the gendered face of the food crisis, that is lowered quality of life. You have a lowered quality of life, worsening infant mortality rate, worsening maternal mortality rate. Now, I have these two charts to show. These are the, look at the map of the world. The red marks show the countries that rely on global market for most of their food supply, that's the net food importers. And look at the regions, how they compare. Of course, sub-Saharan Africa and a lot of the developing countries, they're on the highest side of it. Now, the next slide shows the map, the geography of infant mortality rates. And if you put the two graphs side by side, you can see them splicing almost very neatly over each other. So showing that there's a huge correlation between food deficiency or food insecurity or food crisis, as it were, and quality of life of households. Of course, we say that in mitigating this food crisis, women who we are now saying may find themselves at the center of managing the crisis may find that, you know, their ability to manage is threatened. Now, why is it threatened? The women have been so far not included as much as they should in the value, growing value chain of a lot of commodities because of the gender blindness of policies. Now, the value chain approach is a more recent approach to agricultural development to enhance income and livelihoods. In a lot of countries where governments and development partners are, you know, taking up encouraging value chain of key crops, there is a total gender blindness such that women are left out of this value chain development. Despite the fact that women don't have the comparative advantage in the production system itself because of their low entitlement to land, one would expect that the value chain presents nodes, new nodes for generating income for women. But so far, they are, you know, limited. Of course, familiar literature about the entitlement system that restricts their access and increasing fragility of households due to the food crisis and especially due to the climate change. Now, women in the situation of fragility, gender relations come in, and gender roles dictate that women take charge of the coping mechanisms. One of the ways in which they cope is by selling the prime crops. They sell the prime crops and eat the cheaper ones, you know, in order to make more income. They sell their security crops. They shift to food security crops rather than crops that would generate market surplus and income. Cassava and sweet potato are some of the security crops for the same land that is opened up for. Cassava is even very remunerative now because it is being used in the production of ethanol. It has a lot of demand from the industrial sector. But sweet potato and millets have only use at the household level. So for the same amount of land, the marginal gain for cultivating sweet potato, for cultivating maize instead of sweet potato is really lost there. And fragility is also reflected in the food expenditure of households. You can see from this table, from a study carried out on the food crisis in Nigeria last year, that between 2007 and 2008, the proportion of income that is spent on food has risen astronomically in all the zones of the country. Now, that's this graph is from the other table. This one shows the nutritional effects of the food crisis in Nigeria. You can see there are different zones in the country, and the analysis was carried out by the different zones. Now, this is the 2007 level deficit in protein intake, and the next one is the 2008. For each of the zones, you can see that protein deficiency deficit has increased for all the zones in the country. I don't want to go into the characteristics of the zones, why the deficiency is much higher in some areas. It's not a subject for this presentation. Now, climate change, I'll just quickly run over that, but it's a major intervening factor. I'm sure we know enough about climate change, and we've discussed a bit about it, to know that it is a major factor that is limiting the ability of farmers to cope, and also making their livelihoods more fragile. And the key message is that the causes of climate change are mainly from developed countries. I'm sure there's no contention about that. We have causes in developing countries because of the kind of low technology of agricultural production, for instance, and then because of exploitation of natural resources resulting from poverty, like deforestation. We have low technology agriculture contributing to climate change in developing countries, while other factors, you know, that we know is causing, more factors are causing the climate change from the developed countries. Now, the cross effects, we can look at that later. Now, gender issues also come into the climate change, mainly in terms of who is causing the climate change and who is mitigating, who is at the center of mitigation or adaptation. Of course, women have been seen to contribute inadvertently to climate change by, you know, their livelihood means, exploiting natural resources because they don't have other means of income. They cut down the fuel to sell for energy for their homes. Of course, men also contribute through logging of wood. Women, they scavenge in forests, in reserve areas, scavenge for non-timber forest products as a search for livelihood. All these are leading to deforestation, reducing of forest cover, and degradation of soils. So those are the gender issues in the climate change by which women and men also contribute in different ways to the problem of climate change. And of course, there are gender roles in the adaptation and mitigation of climate change. There are important roles that women can play in adaptation, and they are already playing. And there are important roles that they are playing in the mitigation. But as usual, women who are using their indigenous knowledge, you know, as was aptly demonstrated in the morning, the relevance of indigenous knowledge, especially in problem situation, have been able to, you know, adapt in their own way. But you find that in the process of adaptation, because of limited knowledge, because of a lack of technology, they even worsen the climate change effect. Now, of course, the responses to the food crisis, we have a lot. I have a matrix of some of the types of the category of policy responses that has been recorded. We have macroeconomic policies aimed at lowering domestic food prices, which include some of these. We have demand-side responses in terms of targeted safety nets aimed at improving household food security. And you see that these are the ones where you can begin to talk about a space for women. And from Indira's presentation, it is, we cannot even say that 100% that women will fully benefit from safety net programs unless such policies are engendered to make sure that women are targeted. Then we have supply-side responses to stimulate domestic production and income of producers. Next, I have a series of interventions from different countries. Time will not allow me to go through each one of them, but they all fall under all these categories. Mainly in terms of, you know, trade-related change policies, supply-side production support, and so on. What I was going to do, but my computer did not respond, was I prepared a table, a chart from this one, and added an extra column. I added an extra column. Okay, this one, added an extra column and asked that we try to engender these policies. I mean, this is it's a workshop, and we've been talking about gender blindness. If I were in a position, if I were a policymaker and I was gender aware, what would I do differently? You know, what would I do that these countries or these strategies would not achieve for gender equality? But somehow the paper refused to print. I hope that when you get the papers, maybe you can have a few minutes of exercise. I would have wanted us to have some concrete suggestions and then collate them from different countries and different regions. Maybe we would have some suggestions as some policy prescription, as you were suggesting, but that would not be possible. Now, the last part of my paper is to ask whether Africa and developing countries in general can start on a track of structural transformation. Otherwise, is it feasible, is it possible with all the constraints for developing countries to take advantage of this food crisis and launch the developing world into a track of structural transformation, you know, by looking at strategies to improve their supply dramatically and get out of the net or the trap of being net food importers to satisfy the domestic food need, at the same time generating surpluses to meet the supply shortfalls in much of the developing world. Structural transformation, I don't know if you're familiar with structural transformation literature. It means that a country is transforming from a low level of technology, of technological development, to a higher level. And in terms of agriculture and industry, what it means is that a greater proportion at a lower level, which is called the craft economy level, like we have in much of Africa, a greater proportion is employed in agriculture, yet agriculture is contributing a much lower proportion of the GDP. Now, at a higher level of technological development like we have in the West, you have just about 10% or less in the agri sector, and yet they're able to, you know, feed themselves and feed the rest of the world and contribute a substantial quota to the GDP. Now, can we have a situation, can we envisage a situation where people would move out of agriculture first into the agriculture value chain, where agriculture can be revolutionized to a commercial level, where we move away from this small-scale subsistence agriculture, and women at the center of it would also have to make a choice to move with the supply chain, given some additional skills that will be required, or, you know, stay in this quagmire and watch this opportunity come and go. This food crisis it will probably not go away next year. It will not go away in 2 years' time. It's going to be with us for some time. Now is the time for developing countries and gender advocates to ask ourselves, can we continue to remain in a position of net food importers when any shock in supply from the other side triggers our whole livelihood and pushes our population, especially our women and children, into deeper levels of poverty? I think that I said I have a concern about greater visibility for gender. I have a concern for greater visibility, greater relevance of the agricultural sector to the heart of any economy, especially in developing countries. And I think the potentials are there. The labor is there, and the technology is there if there is adequate capital flow to support technological transmission. But while I would just leave us, I have some suggestions here, you know, that even as we are thinking of structural transformation, there are threats for women. That is, if women are being moved, if farms are being commercialized, it means because of land constraints, a lot of women may initially, on a short term, lose their livelihood. But there can be compensatory policies and programs that ensures that they can move into the value chain of, you know, the surplus production, you know, which is opening up industrialization in the rural areas. We know a lot of advantages that can come from that. You know, the infrastructure would have to be developed. a lot of opportunities for the downstream and upstream sector. My point really is not to decimate or devalue what women have been doing or what gender roles have been doing, but I think after many 30 years or more of women, this struggle to liberate women from poverty, should we begin to look at another pathway from improving gender relations? Are there alternative livelihoods that we're overlooking that women, for which women may have comparative advantage? If we're talking about land transfers would be feasible if land is being given to groups of women. And it means that women also have the opportunity to commercialize in large groups and also build their own value chain with women or with men. It does not necessarily exclude them from agriculture per se. But I want us to chew on this. And in light of what we have been seeing on agriculture, you know, for how long will women be trapped in this system of poverty, food insecurity, scraping a livelihood from little parcels of land, and even struggling, you know, to hold tight to those lands? I think the opportunities are there with the current food crisis. Thank you very much.
Just to play devil's advocate on the issue you raise with climate change and GMOs, a lot of the recent literature is showing that it's not just about the world getting hotter, but about drier regions getting drier and wet regions getting wetter. So I'm wondering, in terms of yield and in terms of addressing some of these issues with drought-resistant crops and so forth, if you want to speak to that. The other issue that I wanted to raise is regarding structural transformation and whether historically, I mean, Ocampo, other people have done a lot of work on looking at how that clearly is a path to better livelihoods for large segments of the populations and a lot of countries that have developed. But what I'm wondering is if this crisis is an opportunity to question that whole model, the question of whether we can just continue to serve export markets or serve the larger buying regions, given that we have almost evolved along this global production line, where can we continue to push that in terms of sustainability, or is this a time to question turning inward a bit more?
I also want to make a few comments or maybe a couple of questions about the reasons of the food crisis. I don't know, maybe I missed it, but I think one of the factors is also, you know, after the tech bubbles, and these has structural reasons like the inequality in the world, extra money, you know, after failing to go to the tech bubble, they, you know, the speculative money moved to the commodity speculation. And that's one of the major reasons also in the increase of the food prices. And you mentioned that the changing diet in the world and the increased population. I totally see your point, but I have a couple of issues with that. First of all, I mean, like you mentioned, animals like cows and, you know, beef production consumes 5 to 6 times more than, or 5 to 6 kilos per 1 pound of meat, I think, or 1 kilogram of meat is produced by 6 kilograms of grain, and the West has been consuming mostly meat. And now the developing countries are trying to increase their living standards. And almost it's suggesting that, no, you shouldn't be like us. And maybe, you know, switch the light towards the West. I mean, I don't know what kind of policy suggestions we can come up with. Rather than telling them, you're having too many babies and you're eating too much meat, you know, as opposed to what kind of power structures are there in the West that, you know, limits this policy space just for the third world countries. I don't know what is your take on these.
said that somewhere that there are two major climatic conditions, temperature and rainfall, and the excess or lack manifests in different manner. The temperature, of course, contributes to drought, you know, which, of course, again has the greater effect in much of the south of the world with desert encroachment. You know, the desert area, lands, crop lands are being lost, you know, due to the drought. And, of course, rainfall has a double edge, as we know, either inadequacy of the rainfall also contributing to the drought, and excessive rainfall, you know, from warming contributing to floods and these monsoons and so on, with all their devastating effects. So the climate change issue is a major topic in itself, and it has so many dimensions. But the relevance here is that it has contributed in many dimensions to the fragility of the livelihood of farmers in the South, but with most of the causal effects resulting from greater prosperity in the north of the world. That is why, you know, I look at prosperity on one side, transmitting to poverty on the other side, all due to climate change and other factors. Well, your question or comment about structural transformation, like I said, this question of structural transformation has its immediate advantages and disadvantages, as we know. But in order to achieve structural transformation in a sustainable manner on a long term, you know, we have to cope with its pros and cons on the short and medium term in order to gain the advantages of structural transformation. And I believe, like you said, that the developed countries of the world have gone through their own path of structural transformation to get to where they are today. And so the other countries, the other half, must tread their own path towards structural transformation. If one half says, look, just stop there, don't produce, we'll be producing for you. And yet you have labor, you have excess labor, you have arable land, you know, and I mean, that is not wise counsel. In as much as we want to stay at the ready to receive assistance, to receive food, we will continue to impoverish our people. We have to, as a developing nation, we have to be ready to tread that path towards structural transformation. And like all other changes, it has its gains and its losses along the way. But I think the most important thing for this forum is that it has great advantage for moving women to, you know, alternative livelihoods, a lot more remunerative livelihoods, perhaps partly from the extreme challenges of entitlement that they are facing currently and that they faced for a long time. That's my main point there. Gul, I'm not sure I get your point. Is it a comment or a question? The second one.
I wanted to hear your maybe views on the, you know, the effect of commodity speculation on the food prices. You know, there were some many items that you listed which are all part of the food crisis problem, but a good chunk of it is also on commodity speculation.
That is a major transmission from the financial crisis to the food crisis, that speculators moved from stock and monetary stock to the commodity market when the money market crashed, as it were. And that fueled, you know, speculation on food prices for futures and options, transmitting to the day-to-day prices that people are feeling on the street. That's a direct effect of the financial crisis to the food crisis. Of course, other effects which I did not mention are the issue of capital flows, reduced capital flows to developing countries as a result of constraints, and reduced remittances as people are losing employment. You know, a lot of people who are working in the in other parts of the world and whose families rely on their remittances, this has contributed a lot to the worsening food insecurity and the negative effects of the food crisis, directly or indirectly transmitting from the financial crisis.
Thank you. And my second point was on the, you know, consumption, like animal product consumption. Because they're not, you know, China, India, or the developing world are not going to not consume animal products because they're protein rich, like it's better living standards. Mm-hmm. So what could be the policy suggestion of such, you know, of pointing out as a reason that this is one of the reasons of the food crisis? Mm-hmm. And why not the consumption of the West is not pointed out? Because they have been consuming animal products. And I actually have a very striking statistics too. You know, this switch to biofuels. I think one, to be able to fill an SUV's tank just for once consumes a person's whole year's grain consumption. And, I mean, you look at the world, you look at the distribution of these cars, I mean, particularly in this country, and, you know, the consumption patterns of meat consumption, and why are they not? I mean, I don't know what kind of policy spaces we have included. Or, you know, when you're pointing out to, okay, East, you know, developing countries are consuming more, mm-hmm. what can we do if this is your...
Well, the what we need to do is what has not been done, what has not been achieved, massive... supply increases, you know, are required to meet growing demand. I mean, it boils down to demand-supply gap, doesn't it? Regardless of where the demand is coming, whether it's from animal or from human or from industry, it simply translates to the need for, you know, phenomenal required increase in supply to meet all these needs. Now, where will that supply increase come from? Will it come, you know, from developed countries with the present constraints, or should it come, you know, by developing countries responding to the gap and attempting to produce more and perhaps begin to export to meet the livestock needs in other parts of the world? I think it boils down to the capacity of the agricultural system, or the policy to correct the structural defects that have limited availability of these crops. And, I mean, where does that start? And where does it stop? It lies, you know, with each country to define its priorities as far as its agricultural policy is concerned. In much of the developing world, the agricultural policies are actually tailored towards commercialization, privatization. And while it has inherent and immediate disadvantages for women and the poor, that is where the need for compensatory policies, you know, would come in. And that's what structural transformation entails. You know, there have to be compensatory policies while you are going through a path of adjustment. And that was done pretty much in the 80s and 90s with respect to the social, the adjustment with the human face, the social policies of structural adjustment, maybe not effectively. It was recognized that these compensatory policies are required to go hand in hand during a period of adjustment.
Thank you, Bola. It was very interesting. Just like in the morning, it really gives a lot of food for thought, everything that you, Yasin, or other speakers today have, Indira has discussed. You know, just looking at the diversity of issues, some talk about water, other talk about, you know, the linkage with trade. I think we should make an extra effort to federate the various movements. I will explain. I know that there are certain groups of, you know, gender equality advocates or women's rights advocate only following issues on water resource management, for example. You would find them in any conference, for example, the African Ministerial Conference on Water. You know, you have certain group of gender advocates who just follow on gender and water resources management. And we have seen the linkage between the food security or sovereignty you've been talking about and the issue of water. The same with the peasants movement or the rural populations, rural movement. There is also a lot of advocacy around the issue of food sovereignty. And I think we need to, just in terms of broadening our constituency for advocacy, we need to look more into the existing movements and how they can be linked up with what GEM wants to achieve. There is another potential link that I see, is that, for example, in the framework of studies that UNIFEM was undertaking in Africa on cross-border trade, you would also see a variety of linkage between the food crisis and the regional integration agenda, with countries like Guinea-Conakry, for example, banning the export of some food items because of the food crisis, because now they want to protect their own country and their market from the food crisis. So you also have that dimension in terms of intra-African trade and the regional integration agenda. And when you really look at the kind of products that each one of our countries produce, we can see that there is a huge demand for some of the products that are exported. I'm just giving an example. Traditionally, in Djibouti, they don't eat fish. You know, they're more into meat products. And their fish was used to be available for sale in other neighboring countries until they decided to have a fisheries agreement with the European Union, and all of a sudden the fish was not there anymore. So I think we should look also into the regional integration mechanisms and how intra-regionally we could do some advocacy about, you know, Africa addressing the food needs of Africa and not keeping this kind of trade path with the former colonizers. Like, you know, in my country, it always seems natural to sell certain products to France, while I'm sure there is a huge demand in the level of the continent. So I think we should just make those linkages as we look into our either advocacy messages or the kind of groups that we are thinking of linking up with. Thank you.
Hi, thank you, Bola. Really quite extensive and very detailed. I have a couple of comments. One is about, I might have missed it, but I wanted to flag, just in case I did, the role of the EU-US subsidies in the food crisis. That's been a huge big debate, our discussion rather. First, two legs of it. One is the role that the dumping of cheap imported food led to the destruction of domestic market and domestic food production. But also increasingly there's some research coming out of a group in France looking at the role of EU, in particular, incentive through subsidy for biofuel production. And then the role of biofuel production in the food crisis. So I think EU subsidies from the north also needs to be expanded on in this discussion. The other level, which is, and I'm talking about, this is identified as long-term structural factors as opposed to the proximate causal factors. The other structural factor I wanted to identify is the non-competitive nature, almost rather oligopolistic nature of the global food market, dominated as it is by the few grain cereal producers, and also just even smaller fertilizer producer, and their control of global fertilizer prices, and how that prices has not significantly gone down, even when oil went down. So that is a market issue, it's a structural issue. The demand growth issue, that is a huge, I mean, I think your point, Gul, about the West is really important. But there has been some sense in which among certain quarters, for example, if you look at the UN Task Force on Global Food, there is a sort of an intonation that a significant causal factor is demand generated by India and China. And I think there's been significant amount of work showing that that is a red herring, that in fact, that the demand, if you look at the data from India and China, that their demand has not significantly risen in the 12 months preceding the food crisis, enough to create the problem. And that furthermore, China has a surplus in its food trade from 2000 to the present. And in addition, India is a net exporter of food products, including meats, dairy, and cereals. So it's very, given those realities, how can significant part of the demand for food be blamed on those countries? And nobody, as Gulat's pointed out, nobody's talked about the EU, US, and North. But there's every time you read, there is something about demand emerging from India and China. And the data that has been worked on by groups like Oxfam, Christian Aid, and others have shown that that is not true. Do I have another one? Anyway, speculation, I won't go into it. But there is enough data showing that in 2000, speculative expenditure from the financial market on commodity market was about $45 billion. By 2005, it was $175 billion. This is commodity speculation over the counter market. And if you look at 2005 to the present, it's gone up even more dramatically. Right? So the data exists to show that, despite what some quarters would like not to argue.
Thank you very much, Bola, for your presentation. It's really, it was quite interesting. The issue of our food crisis and food security, truly women are at the center of this whole issue. The ignoring women out of the equation, then you are getting a very big part of the equation. You know, you are remaining with something very small, so that equation cannot really be solved. I liked the slide where you indicated that although there is the emphasis of promotion of value chains, these value chains are gender blind. And I think this goes to what Indra was saying in her presentation, the need for engendering the whole agricultural process. Because if you look at the value chain, basically you are saying that you are looking at agriculture from the garden to the table, or from the garden to the market. And in between, there are various elements which feed into each other. In Uganda, currently we are formulating our national development plan, and we are also emphasizing the issue of the value chain, the intra-sector and inter-sector linkages for the key sectors. You know, we are looking at drivers of the economy. We are looking at the enabling sectors, and then we are looking at the support and the complementary. Now, if you take agriculture, what basically happens is that within the intersectoral linkages or within agriculture itself, one has to look at things like agricultural inputs, agricultural knowledge. But we do know that, and someone mentioned it, I don't know who, in the morning, when training is organized, who attends it is the men. But then the men do not necessarily pass over this information to their wives. I mean, some of them will come back in the night when they are drunk or from the workshops, you know, they just continue to the bars. And, you know, and that is how life goes on. So unless the women are given an opportunity to get access to the agricultural inputs, it really becomes difficult for them to improve their productivity. I mean, we have seen the issue, I don't know, was it Rania, maybe talking about fertilizer for Malawi, I don't know. But I mean, who gets access to this fertilizer? Because in my country, we've not really gone very much as far as fertilizer is concerned. But we do know that actually fertilizer helps to improve productivity. But if fertilizer has got a cost, and I really liked, I mean, that it is a very high cost. How can women access that when actually the price of fertilizer is even higher than the price of the food at the market? You know, those are real issues that need to be explored. I mean, the possibility of subsidies for fertilizer. But beyond the agriculture sector, if you just concentrate within the sector and not looking at the interlinkages, I mean, you won't go very far. And you brought the example of the cobweb theorem. The prices is high, and then, you know, the fluctuating prices. But if one said that, okay, let us look at what are those complementary sectors, complementary to agriculture, the issue of marketing becomes very, very important. It means that marketing has to be really organized so that one can be able to avoid those fluctuations. And I liked the idea of the warehouse system that you presented in the slide. But this, in actual fact, it is not really working to a great extent. You know, a lot of people say, oh, yes, you can have this warehouse, and people can bring in their produce, and we can give them some cheats. They can even present these cheats to the bank, and then they can maybe able to access credit. In reality, these are not working. But ideally, they would really be very good. I mean, it would be a very good idea if it were working and systems are in place to ensure that when there is that surplus, the excess is put into a warehouse so as to stabilize the prices. But there is also the issue of infrastructure, the roads to the market. I mean, women are always exploited because maybe there is no proper road system to get to the market. Maybe you have to go through all these small rivers and all that. But if there is a proper road that the woman can easily take her produce to the market, then she would not be exploited. But there is also the issue of water for production. I liked your slide on climate change, because we've been talking about climate change. But I must say that when we are developing our thematic areas, we did not look at climate change. Well, when I remembered it, but then I said, oh, but. How does one start? You know what I feared? I feared that if you say, let's have something on climate change, then they'll put Sylvia and you're the leader and you don't know how to go about it. So it maybe it can be presented later, but somebody to lead it, you know, those kind of fears that, oh, you're going to lead something which you really don't have a proper, you know. So, I mean, the issue of water for production is very, very important, because there is a lot of, the weather is really these days, I don't know about Nigeria, in my country now, it's really unpredictable. Today you plant, it rains, maybe two rains, three rains, you get excited, you say, now I'm going to plant my crops. Then after 3 weeks or 1 month, it gets dry, and it gets dry completely, almost now up to the time of when you're supposed to be harvesting, there is nothing because your crops have really dried up. So unless this issue of water for production is also addressed, it really becomes difficult to talk about food security. And without food security, you cannot avoid food crisis. So I feel that let's promote women into the equation, and let us look at the value chain. And let us engender this whole issue of the value chain, as Indra was saying in the morning.
I'll start from you, Sylvia. All your points, very enlightening, adding new perspectives. The issue of the value chain. Value chain analysis is a broad area, and there's a lot of potential, you know, for, you know, work to be done to identify production, I mean, income nodes, we call them, you know, nodes along the value chain, the production value chain itself, where you integrate backwards, and then the market value chain, where you integrate. It's limitless, you know, the opportunities there. For entrepreneur, any entrepreneur, you know, without the burden of requiring land, you know, what I'm just saying is that this burden of land access, yes, it is okay. Like Taco said, there will always be interest groups that are interested, that will be pushing a particular issue. Fine. And then they will be supported, and they'll be getting results, because everybody cannot, all women cannot move into the value chain anyway. And then the production value chain, you still require, you know, the land. So it's like distributing the risk, you know, among the various possibilities. So what we're doing is trying to identify possibilities for women, and as you have said, they are very, very numerous. Some of these things we're talking about, they're opening up, raising questions about what GEM, you know, might want to do, because we have advocates, like you said, interest groups. They need the information. They need the, talking about evidence, you know, I mean, there are different kinds of evidence. A kind of strategic write-up for to identify possibilities for engendering agriculture, or for enhancing the prospects for women in agriculture, for, you know, transforming agricultural prospects for women. You know, there are a lot of issues that will be taken up by advocates. Those who are interested in pushing these issues can take it up and, you know, go to governments or organizations and say, look, we have been able to identify some place where women can move into. So also the water lobbyists. Of course, water is very, very crucial for whatever, for production, for industrialization at any level. And, you know, the beauty of this water lobby, the importance of it is that it's from a low level to a high level of a technology of water use, water harvesting, and so on. I mean, if that can be that can progress sufficiently in the interest of women, then the question of droughts, or I mean transient droughts with the delayed rainfall and so will not occur, because production will be mostly through irrigation, and the question of waiting for rain-fed agriculture would be a thing of the past. That is one of the things that are drawing back our agriculture. So all the, like Taco said, there are different lobbies for different issues, and this is how it's supposed to be. Everything cannot be put on the table at the same time, and so the work of maybe empiricists, or, you know, whatever we call ourselves, is to, you know, do concrete identification, you know, strategic write-ups, which these people can take to the lobbying table, because what we say is that our lobbies, our advocates, even from our countries, they go to, you know, WTO and all these ones almost empty-headed, and then rely on consultants who don't know the real issues in our countries. So if women from this kind of network can produce, can service the advocates, I would call them, give them their weapons of advocacy, because, I mean, if they go and say, well, women are, you know, fighting the water right, okay, I mean, let us give them empirical evidence of what would change if policy can address this problem. So I'm just linking what she said with what you said earlier, to say that there is room, that the market is broad, interregional market is very, very vibrant, if only we were looking inwards. That is what AU and all the regional agreements are for. I mean, we've been at this for decades, but I mean, it is shameful, I would say, that we're still looking, you know, to the developer for food, when we know that we have the market is there, the demand is there, the resources are there, if our governments are doing what is right, and we know what we're talking about. There's a lot of bad governance issue involved in many of our countries. So that is a subject for another that discussion, but we know it's very relevant. Most people know what is right, but the political will to do what is right, and then the knowledge to really zero in on what is workable is what they lack, and that's the kind of service you can give. Mariama, the issue of subsidies and the market, the oligopolistic corporations, you know, dominating the market, is an issue of the usual politics of WTO, which for some reason the developed countries are able to either sidetrack guidelines or use, you know, this leeways, what do you call them, to their best advantage, while the other half are not using the opportunities that are there to enhance their own sectors. So I think it still boils down to the same thing of the capacity of the advocates, the lobbies, those who are, you know, coming for this issue of the subsidy, EU subsidy under the Common Agricultural Program has been going on for a long time. I don't know what the current, you have seen, gave as a figure, but some years back it was like $2 subsidy per day on a cow. Maybe it's more than that now. And those are really bad evidences to show that other countries have to sharpen, you know, their skills, are really looking at the leeways that they have to checkmate the powers that be. I want to say that there are a lot of empirical facts that we see. I said this is broadly a conceptual paper. You know, I'm just thinking through a lot of issues. And if one decides to now find empirical substance for each one, we're going to have, I hope, something that we can, it's going to be a very big paper, but then there are potentials to think through some of this and get the facts, the relevant facts, and put forward something as the end product of a thinking process as to possibilities for agriculture in Africa and developing countries. Lastly, I want to talk about the issue of education. I mentioned it in the morning, and I do think it's very, very, very crucial to the liberation, to the bargaining power, to the empowerment of women at any level. Any program of empowerment, quote unquote, that does not incorporate education is still beating about the bush. Not necessarily formal education. We have seen that women who are exposed to just about 4 weeks of adult literacy come out, you know, really empowered. You know, they begin to see issues as they've never seen. And they are actually more militant. In my country, they are the most militant in terms of bringing their. They say, oh, you never told me this. Oh, I didn't know this. Oh, now I know. They will know me. And they are, you know, they are in the legislative houses giving it to them. I mean, they are more courageous than those of us who have all the education in the world, because maybe their stakes are not as high. They don't have an image problem. Anyway, we have found, our studies have found, that education lies at the heart of any, you know, strategy to improve power relations. Even when the opportunities are there, women are more encouraged. They are more articulate. They have the confidence to, you know, to approach the powers that be if they have any measure of education. And then, of course, education modifies their fertility behavior and the other issues around household livelihood, welfare of their families. So I would keep emphasizing that any programs should retain education of women at the heart of it, whether it is for farmers or non-farmers. I don't know if there are any other issues. Okay. Yep.
I think it is very important, and maybe we haven't treated here, and maybe for the next conference, it will be good if one, two, or three persons of us can work the relation between the derivatives market, the commodities, and what happened with all these food prices. And also, what is the role of these big companies that are the ones that are spoiling all this market? Because we can see most of the prices of the commodities, especially the agricultural prices in the futures market, are made in the Chicago Board of Trade. Even the countries that export the corn, the wheat, the other rice, they don't decide the price. The price is decided in the international financial market, and that is very important. And the even they decide 3 decades ago which countries were going to produce coffee, because the coffee was a product from Brazil and Colombia. And then they decided to expand this to other countries in Africa and Malaysia. And so, and Vietnam also. They weren't coffee producers before this time. So to only to decrease the price of the coffee. So now there's a monopoly of the coffee, but of only one, two, or three in three hands. So I think that we have maybe to have a research how are these prices are being defined, and also these big companies that are controlling, especially the commodities markets. That will be.
First, I would say that it's a good idea, Alicia, and maybe we shouldn't think that we have to start from scratch, because IATP, the International Agricultural and Trade Policy Institute, has been doing some work on it, and there's a guy named Steve Putson. He's been really looking at the Steve Suppan, S-U-P-P-A-N. He was on a panel that I chaired last week at the financial crisis, and he's really a big expert in this area and has tremendous expertise and has been making proposals. Also, Hungtad has been looking at it, so we have work to build on for that. So that was one. The other thing I wanted to ask actually both all of you, Indira, Yasin, and yourself, and maybe Gul, who's coming on later, if you have taken a look at any of the three major attempt to deal with agriculture. I mean, the one that I think we should look at, the UN Task Force on the Food Crisis that gave its report into the Secretary General last September, and they had a comprehensive framework for food security. It had about 8 points. None of it was gendered, I could tell you that for sure. I looked at it, but it's worth looking at. The other thing is there's this Global Partnership for Agriculture and Food Security. Haven't looked at their document. But there is the agricultural equivalent of the IPC. You know, in climate change, there's the IPC, which brings together all these scientists. So IASTD, it's IAASTD, International Assessment for Agricultural and Food Knowledge, Technology, and Science. And they recently put out a tremendous report. They brought together over 400 authors, scientists from different disciplines, NGO academics, and it's kind of the state of the art on looking at agriculture as a multifunctional sector and where we want to go globally, much like the IPC assessment report on climate change. And it's a tremendous amount of work. It's brought together all of the thinking and thought on agriculture and food security. And I have not looked at it beyond trying to pick out stuff for climate change. So I didn't go into it in great details. It's huge. And it might be something that we might want to look at to see what role, if any, they discussed about women and gender. But I would suggest that we at least have to be conversant with those as international discussion pieces, along with our national and regional context.
What do you think the network should be doing, right? Topical issues, hot issues like this, before the UN, before the bodies move too far ahead, and we find ourselves scrambling after something that is already done. This is a time to look at these issues before the solutions are coming out critically. I also did mention that when the PowerPoint goes online, I would appreciate if, I'm not sure if I have that table there, if you look at the policy frameworks, the policy categories, the policy options that have been coming out, and just ask yourself, can we engender, and can any of this be engendered, you know, beyond the bland, the mainstream? That would be something very instructive if you can come up with a few concrete policy suggestions there.
Yep. Let me share with you some of my experience of monitoring several products in Peru. First of all, to tell you, thank you very much for the presentation. I found it very interesting. Well, I would like to tell you that I think the impact of climate exchange is worst in food security than we thought. For instance, in Peru, I saw that in the Andean region, we have lot of droughts, no?
Droughts.
Yeah. And in the jungle, we have floods. Yeah. So the impact are very, very, very higher. And I think in this matter, the countries of the north have a lot of responsibility because most of the industries of the world are in the north, no? So I think it's very, very important that in countries as United States, they reduce the level of emission, no? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the impact will be worse and faster, no? Mm-hmm. That's why I see in Peru. For instance, I can tell you that the level of snow in the mountains is reducing very faster. Last year, I went with a mission that came from Brussels to Lima. I saw the mountains at 5,000 meters altitude. They don't have snow. Mm. So there is no water, there is no food. No? So that, for me, that's important. Other impact that I see in climate change is the skin cancer in persons. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In countries as Peru, that we have people living in 5,000 meters or 4,000 meters altitude, the level of the skin cancer is higher. Mm-hmm. No? People as me, I can pay sunblock. But the native people don't use sunblock. They don't have money to pay that, to buy a sunblock. Mm-hmm. No, so it's this it.